That's right.
Sure. Get everything arranged. I believe we're all situated now. Our next case this afternoon is State v. Woodard. Good afternoon, Ms. Douglas.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, opposing counsel, members of our audience. I'm representing the interest of the appellant, Glenn Woodard, in this matter. This case arose out of Sarpy County on a felony conviction for a bench trial regarding the allegation of witness tampering. He was ultimately convicted at the bench trial and sentenced to a term of 1 to 3 years of incarceration. Today, there are basically two issues to discuss before this court. The first is with regards to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, and the second is whether or not the lower court erred in admitting what's Exhibit 1 from the trial. First, I'll start with the sufficiency of the evidence argument. Basically, the alleged victim in this case, and she is the victim now because he was convicted, was never summoned or subpoenaed or noticed to appear at trial, which is relevant to the statutory elements of witness tampering because, as you note in Section D of Statute 28919, it says, absencing themselves from any proceeding or investigation to which one has been legally summoned. It is our position that the victim in this case was never summoned or ordered to appear in court in any way. They go into the substance of Exhibit 1, which is a conversation between the victim and the defendant in which they're discussing whether or not Ms. Guerrero ought to come to court. In that conversation, the defendant says, if you do this, referring to if you submit an affidavit or talk to the prosecutor or do something prior to trial, then you won't have to come to court. At that point, she had not been subpoenaed or noticed to come to court, and he wasn't suggesting that if subpoenaed, she shouldn't go. It was his assumption that the case would be resolved prior to trial. In connection with that, she, being the victim, had already stated in the call that she was not attending, and in fact she talked about a coworker who had a similar situation and said, how can I handle this? So very extensively they talked in hypotheticals and prior to any allegation of her attention or order to appear in court. Also, looking at the case law that was cited from the state's brief, basically the allegations that they have made before the court are that it's someone who's being advised or enticed to not appear. Those cases all talk about people that are under the condition of a subpoena or a notice to appear. So this case is distinguishable from the state's cases. Based on that information, we do not feel that the government reached its burden of establishing a prima facie case of witness tampering. But the more important and I think interesting issue before the court today is regarding the omission of Exhibit 1. Exhibit 1 was a jail call, specifically jail call number 5. And this call occurred on October 26th, and it was from the Sarpy County Jail. The only evidence presented at trial was basically this phone call. And the way that the state did so was they called Mr. Schoolfield, who is the keeper of the records for the jail calls. And he extensively explained how they record all calls and how in the ordinary course of business he produces those calls. He doesn't listen to them. He doesn't attest to the identity of the declarant or the validity of those calls. But he talks about how they have a sophisticated jail monitoring system in which an inmate will enter their data number and they have a previous recording of their voice when they're first booked in. That call, whenever they enter their data number, monitors that voice to determine who the declarant is at the time so that if someone is unauthorized to use the phone, it cuts off the call.
What happens if the inmate whose PIN is associated with the call gives the phone to a different inmate? What happens in the system then?
What happens is if you look at the transcript of the trial on page 14, we talked about that, and I asked him what happened in that situation. What happens is it's a continuous monitoring. So he said approximately every 30, 45 seconds, it updates and verifies the identity. So if at any point it's a different voice or the computer believes it's a different voice, it'll say unauthorized call and terminate the call. So, and then it, the report that is generated, which came along with Exhibit 1, turns red and it states that it was an unauthorized call. So during the trial, that report indicated it was green, which indicated that the entire time the person on the call was supposedly the person with the data number.
And does the evidence show us how long that call number 5 was?
It was 15 minutes, which is the maximum time you're allowed to have a jail call prior to its termination. So it may be a little over, a little less, but it used the entire time period. And that call was assigned a data number that belonged to an individual named Jay Sabota, who is not the defendant in this case. So on cross-examination, we asked about the statements made on that call, and he said, well, from this, what I can testify to is that according to our jail records, this phone call was made by the inmate who has that data number because it matches. So the state then calls an officer to identify the declarant because there were two objections. One was hearsay, which the lower court admitted as a business record. The second objection was a foundational objection as to the identity of the declarant.
And did the court rule on the foundation objection?
Not that I believe. The court acknowledged there was a foundation objection, initially stated you have not laid sufficient foundation, you need to lay some more, which isn't in the record, but we rested for the day. We came back the next day, picked up the evidence, we renewed the objection. The court said, it's a business record, I'm letting it in. And that never made any further findings. That in itself should be grounds to remand this case for either a new trial or consideration on that objection.
Was there a request that the court specifically rule on the foundation objection?
No.
After the court said, I'm allowing it in as a business record, which doesn't address foundation.
What happened at that point was the objection was continued and re-raised repeatedly as to foundation, and the court instructed us to move on. Okay. So it was felt that it was appropriate at that time to not further argue with the court about foundation.
So let's talk about Officer Munson then, who identified the speaker in call number 5 as the defendant.
Officer Munson, basically, his role in this case, he was not the investigating officer. He was not the officer that was involved in the underlying case. He was the officer that went to Sarpy County Jail, where Mr. Woodard was detained on other charges, and booked him and arrested him for the pending witness tampering charge. He testified at trial that he had a conversation of at most 5 minutes. He said it was a very short conversation, maybe 5 minutes, and that was on transcript page 74. Based on that information, he then testified at trial. Based on that conversation from 8 months ago, today, sitting in court, I can tell you this recorded voice is identical to the person that I spoke to in person at the jail.
So does that go to the admissibility of the exhibit or to the weight it should be given?
I believe that it was characterized as both. My position is that it ought to go to the weight of the evidence. It goes to basically show two things. One, that this is a call from the jail and it was made to and who it was made by. They buttressed that with the phone number of the victim. A phone number is something that is a registered item. It doesn't mean that the person that answers that phone call is that person. So what I think is, to try to answer your question, State versus Ferris, I think, is the case that's more addresses that, because that is a case where a woman was lined and was assaulted, and there the court said, well, she can identify these people by their voices. In that case, she had known those individuals since birth, or at least for 3 years on the other defendant. Additionally, since she was blind, she has heightened senses and acuity to sound. Here, we are talking about a 5-minute conversation in a jail setting for the purposes of detaining and charging someone, not for establishing their identity, listening to their voice intonations. The calls weren't recorded. It was a totally different environment. So based on that, it would be...
So call number 5 was associated with the PIN associated with Jay Swoboda.
Correct.
Right. Did Detective Muncie ever speak with Jay Swoboda to identify his voice?
To my knowledge, no. And certainly it wasn't in the record, but that was never testified to.
So he didn't hear Swoboda's voice, but he heard 5 minutes of your client's voice.
Correct.
Well, if I understand what you said earlier, I think you said it goes to the weight. So how can we find error in the court's admission of Exhibit 1?
Well, I guess it depends. If you're going to turn it over on the foundational issue, it goes to the admissibility as to the foundation of the call. But if you decide the foundation issue is not an issue, then it would go to the prima facie case for weight. So in that regard, it's both.
To your other assigned error.
Yes, okay. And now I'm completely out of time, if I may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
My name is George Love on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. As counsel has pointed out, there are basically two issues here: the sufficiency of the evidence and the authenticity of the recording. The standard of review is viewed, the evidence is viewed most favorably to the state, and the evidence showed that Mr. Woodward asked Guerrero to make it right and present a statement that her previous statement to the police regarding the domestic violence that occurred on October 8th, in which he was in jail for, then he tried to coerce her into not appearing in court on the domestic violence charge and to proffer an affidavit or a false statement to the police that her statement regarding the domestic violence was false and she made it all up because she was angry.
Mr. Love, can you address the argument that the statute only applies in the witness tampering scenario if the victim has been subpoenaed, and there was no evidence she had been subpoenaed in the domestic relations case in this case?
I think we'll go through it. Paragraph A, testify or inform falsely. Please put in an affidavit that recants your prior statement. An affidavit is an oath statement under oath. A applies. B, withhold any testimony, information, document, or thing. Please do not appear in court. I don't want you there. If you're subpoenaed, please don't show up. Elude legal process. If you get subpoenaed, just don't show up anyway. That's C. D, absent himself or herself from any proceeding or investigation. Please don't show up to the trial.
If you're subpoenaed.
It hits all of them. It hits all of the statutes. He hit the trifecta. He hit all of the elements of the statute on witness tampering.
What about the argument that she indicated later in the conversation she wasn't going to appear anyway because she had spoken to somebody else about the situation who had advised her she didn't need to show up?
This isn't a contract case, Your Honor. It's not a condition precedent that somebody say, I'm not going to show up before someone asks, do not show up. That's the...
It goes to whether she's actually being coerced. If she's already made up her mind she's not going to show up, then there's no coercion?
I disagree with that. It's the defendant's statement and his intent that is the violation of the statute, Your Honor. His intent was to get her not to show up. Well, I already talked to a worker. Let's reinforce that. Don't show up, please. And if you get subpoenaed, don't show up. And change your story. The evidence viewed most favorably to the state clearly supports the witness tampering statute. As far as the authentication, the evidence at trial was that Mr. Armstrong, from the telephone company that provides the service to the Sarpy County Jail, testified as to the process of the service. Nowhere was it claimed that the voice identification procedure was 100% effective. In fact, I think that was even discounted in the transcript. Nobody, and 100% is not necessary in order to authenticate a document. You had first how the process works from the owner of the telephone company. Then you had the administrator of the Sarpy County Jail go through his testimony as to how the process works with PIN numbers, voice identification, transferring of recorded phone calls to CDs, and so on and so forth. All of that prior foundation. Then you have voice identification. Under 27901, somebody saying that is Joe Fenorchi's voice is sufficient in order for the admissibility of that document, so long as the foundation supports the idea that the witness testifying has heard the voice before and can recognize it.
So speaking of
foundation, it was admissible.
Speaking of foundation, what's your response to the argument being made that the foundation objection was never ruled on by the court?
It's waived, and first of all. And secondly, the foundation objection is a general objection, and unless you specify to the court specifically what your foundation objection is, you've waived it for appellate review.
And you're saying that's what occurred here?
Absolutely. There are no further questions. We would ask that you affirm the conviction in all respects. Thank you.
No further questions.
Thank you.
And I believe appellant used all of her time. Okay. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate you being here today. You are excused and your case is submitted.